Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Every few months, news breaks about another massive cyber hack or cybersecurity breach. The Equifax data breach is the latest example. That gets less attention. What gets less attention is cybercrime, criminal acts that don't necessarily involve a hacker hunched over a screen full of code. Sociology professor and cybercrime program coordinator at Old Dominion University in Virginia, Roderick Graham, recently wrote about the distinction for The Conversation. We'll have a link to that on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Roderick Graham joins us now by phone. Welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So last year alone, nearly 300,000 reports of cybercrime were filed with the FBI. Can you put that in perspective? Is that part of an ongoing trend? And how many of those are cybercrime?
Well, all of those are technically cybercrimes. And it's from what we know, it's rising. In fact, that number is probably a gross understatement because most people just simply don't report those things. In fact, I think most people don't even realize that they can report their crimes to the FBI, so they go unreported.
Why would they not report it anywhere?
Well, so sometimes it's just a matter of knowledge. So I would imagine that most people would say, well, if I've been a victim of identity theft, I may go to the local police. But then they may say, well, what's the odds of someone catching that person, or even with romance scams or other types of financial fraud. So they make a calculation and say, well, what's the odds of me getting some restitution? And so they don't go.
As far as romance scams go, I've been covering those for years as far as, mm-hmm. you know, through the particularly through the Department of Aging and that kind of a thing. Mm-hmm. It's an age-related thing often. But what does it have to do particularly with cybercrime?
Well, people are defrauded, so it's certainly not a crime to be dishonest in a relationship. But what tends to happen is scammers try and develop some type of emotional connection, and then once they've done that, then they try and extract some type of money from a victim. So that then is fraud.
So the usual cybersecurity things like passcodes, passwords, all that kind of stuff doesn't really apply here because people are usually letting them in.
Sure, it's more psychological and sociological than technological. What the research suggests is that scammers tend to cast a wide net, and those who are caught in that net are those who are in need at the time. So you mentioned that you were working with the Department of Aging. I can't remember exactly.
Well, it had to do with elder crime.
Okay. So at that stage in someone's life, they're often alone in need of emotional connection. So scammers just cast out this net, and that demographic would be the one who's most in need. So when that happens, your defenses are down. You're not likely to evaluate things as objectively as you should. And so then you become caught in this you know, false love story. It has nothing to do with technology, of course.
Right. It could be by phone or by mail or any kind of thing like that.
Right. And you can't code your way, or it's very difficult. I think some dating sites they attempt to algorithmically detect who might be a scammer, but it's very difficult to do that.
Are dating sites a big problem here?
Yes, they tend to be one of the main ways, if not the primary way in which a scammer connects with a victim online.
You said that cybercrime doesn't get enough attention. Why doesn't it get more attention?
It's really weird. I sometimes tell, because I get this question quite a bit, and so I use this analogy of it's the same as the Wall Street Main Street dynamic. Mm. That kind of has a negative connotation, but I'm not using it that way. It's just that our national leaders tend to focus on protecting government networks and economic institutions. So both Obama and Trump have made it a priority to invest in cybersecurity. And so we just forget that individuals and families are being victimized as well.
We're talking about cybersecurity and how it compares and contrasts with cybercrime. My guest is Roderick Graham. He's a sociology professor and cybercrime program coordinator at Old Dominion University. If you've been the victim of cybercrime, want to tell us your story, maybe educate other people about what you went through, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. One of your concerns is not that there's not enough research going on in the area of cybercrime. What research has been done?
There's some research, and it tends to focus on there's a little on romance scams. We know enough now to really educate people about romance scams. There's been some research, including my own, on cyberbullying, but compared to traditional crime and then also cybersecurity, there's just not that critical mass of scholars and research on these issues.
So what would you like to see? What research?
Well, I think that it's probably better to start with research centers where scholars tend to ask certain questions and then collect data. In my case, I have a difficult time finding data on romance scams, identity theft, cyberbullying, just because people aren't asking those questions and writing the grants to get that funding to do that research.
If dating sites are a big source of this kind of cybercrime, are they doing anything? You said they've tried to work out algorithms to weed them out, but are mm-hmm. they reporting crimes? Are they doing anything to help?
Sure. One dating website in particular, or maybe this is with more than one, but the last one I looked at, they ask people who have been victims to report those profiles, and then they post those profiles on their website so that people who are using their platform can at least see who has been a scammer in the past.
If you suspect somebody's a scammer but you're not sure, they've asked for money but you haven't necessarily given it to them, is there any way to report them and get them screened out?
You could probably report this to the Internet Crime Complaint Center, IC3. I tend to focus more on preventative measures.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, we know that that a victim's defenses are down, and that's when they become a victim. So I tell people, look, if you can, and you meet someone who you think is a potential suitor, ask someone else to evaluate their profile. Theoretically, if that person is not in need, then they can see that person more objectively.
Mm-hmm.
Also, there are some things you can, on your dating profile, you know, make it clear that you don't make it a policy to send money to someone overseas. That doesn't mean you're not open to a relationship, but if you put that there at the beginning, then a potential scammer will be less likely to try and develop a relationship. And then there's one last thing that I tell people, and it's give yourself a cool out period. So we know that what scammers tend to do is that they try and have repeated communications, days and days and weeks on end, so that they can create this link and a shared story between a scammer and victim. Well, if you can give yourself a little time away from those communications, that will help you think a bit more objectively about the person you're communicating with.
You know, I know about people who have been worried about their family members being involved in these kind of things, and they just can't get out for some reason. Is there any way anybody can help somebody they care about?
Well, I don't know. I mean, the things that I have read is that you're right. It's extremely difficult once someone is in that frame of mind. People want to keep the stories that they have in their head, and so I don't know what at that point one could do other than simply talk to the person.
Mm-hmm. What is the FBI doing? I mean, they're getting these increasing numbers of reports year by year. What are they doing?
Well, they do investigate romance scams. It's just that there's, in fact, I think that conversation piece, I used a report from the FBI to start that piece off when I talked about Amy being scammed out of that money. I think
right.
It was $2 million. So they do investigate these things. It's just that the volume the number of cases is overwhelming for a federal agency.
Okay, yeah, you start off that piece with the $2 million over the course of several months or
That's
years.
That's quite a bit, isn't
That's
it?
That's a lot of money. I mean, wouldn't one thing to do is not tell anybody how much money you have?
Well,
I mean...
Well, that's where
I mean, talk about hitting the jackpot.
that's really something. I mean, it's amazing how people are so reluctant to you know, not get out of that story. I mean, it's not just romance scams. It's even with the 419 or Nigerian scams, as they're often called. It's the same dynamic. I mean, once someone believes that, you know, a big payday is coming down the line, they'll send money repeatedly, thousands of dollars. I think $2 million is a bit much, but
good example.
Yes. Yeah.
Let's see. Sylvia in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Sylvia.
Hi.
What happened?
Hello. Yeah.
I ran into a scam that was a fake tech support scam. Apparently I clicked on something that gave me a. I don't know. They put something on my computer that made this really loud alarm. It said, "Call Apple support immediately." Kind of scary. And I called, and actually, I didn't call right away, but I was having trouble with my computer on and off. And so finally, I called the number and didn't even think to check it with the Apple support number I had. Well, I couldn't because I couldn't do things with my computer. And I called them, and they took over my computer, which, I mean, Apple, they don't take it over, but they get it mm-hmm. so they can look at the screen. But they actually took it over, and they showed me a page that said I had a virus called Kubeface or a worm or something. And which I later learned was made to attack Facebook, and it's kind of an old thing. But anyway, I didn't know that. So I saw this, and they showed me this long list of people that could access my personal information. And they could fix it, and make sure nothing like that happened again. For a price, of course, $500. And I said, oh, my gosh, you know, I'm a retired senior. I can't afford that. Oh, well, and you qualify for the senior discount.
Does that sound familiar, Roderick?
It does. It's those kinds of scams. There are variations of them all over the place. The thing that struck me was she said she clicked on a link, and that's usually the way that virus is delivered onto your computer. It's a virus probably that was on her mm-hmm. computer. And so to me, at this point in our internet lives, I never click on any link from anyone I don't know.
Yeah.
Like it's just no. I think when I was younger in the 90s, it was okay to do that because people weren't so devious. But at this point, and even research shows that, you know, we might imagine that we are connected to billions of people online, but in reality, we pretty much have our connections already. And so, you know, if someone emails you or you're getting some link from someone that you don't know, it's never a good policy to click on it.
Sylvia, thanks for that call. We appreciate it. Roderick Graham, thanks to you as well. Lots to think about. We appreciate your time.
All right. Thanks a lot.
Roderick Graham is a sociology professor and cybercrime program coordinator at Old Dominion University. We've been talking about cybercrime and cybersecurity. One doesn't necessarily protect you from the other. More Tech Tuesdays coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Online shopping has become a go-to when it comes to finding the perfect mattress. But the strategy is heavily dependent on reviews to make an informed decision, and that's led to aggressive tactics and even lawsuits as mattress companies vie for a place in our bedrooms. Writer David Zacks recently wrote about the battlefield of online mattress retail for Fast Company. He joins us by phone. Welcome to the show, David.
Hi, thanks for having me.
When did buying a mattress online become a thing?
I think it's been in about 5 years. I really think if you rewind 5 years, the mattress e-commerce brands had about 0% of market share, and now they have something like, 10% or more.
That's a lot in 5 years because a lot of people buy mattresses.
Indeed.
How many are sold online now? Do we know?
Well, now we will have a chance to fact check my math. So I think the overall mattress business is $14 billion. And this year, it's poking up around 10%. About $1.2 billion, I think, is projected to be sold online this year.
How many online mattress companies are out there? Are these mattress companies that sell at bricks and mortar places too, or what?
Yeah, so there's a few dominant companies, the mattress e-commerce brands. The main one, the one most people know, is Casper. Mm-hmm. Casper certainly would seem to have the lion's share of the market in mattress e-commerce. Nipping at the heels of Casper are a few brands like Lisa and Purple. These leading brands tend to have partnerships with brick-and-mortar stores. So I think Target is featuring Casper mattresses. West Elm is featuring Lisa mattresses. And then there's really almost like 100 other mattress e-commerce brands, but some of these are very minor. It turns out that it's actually not that hard to get into the mattress business. You can sort of sign up with a foam supplier and be in business pretty quickly.
Yeah, I guess so. So the big issue here is mattress reviews. That's what online shoppers rely on. I didn't know mattress reviewers could make money.
Yeah, so my story on Fast Company is really kind of an exploration of this larger economy called affiliate marketing. And basically what this means in many cases is that really anyone, any blogger can go online, put up a review of a product. And so long as they put up a special link to a mattress e-commerce website or maybe Amazon.com, they can get a commission on sales from the products that they review.
How can this be legal?
Well, because there are no laws against it, I guess. So long as the reviewers disclose that they have a financial arrangement with the companies they are reviewing, they are not running afoul of any laws. Now, in the case of my story, Casper, the mattress company, felt that the mattress reviewer that they sued was breaking the law because they felt that he wasn't disclosing sufficiently clearly his financial arrangements to people reading his blog.
Yeah, I was going to say, what does that disclosure need to look like?
Sure. So basically, the FTC has guidelines that if you're going to go review mattresses or any other product and link to online stores, you need to disclose conspicuously, really in the same vicinity as the link that your users may be clicking, that you earn a commission on sales. Some bloggers are scrupulous and observe this and some aren't, and there's not very strict enforcement at this time.
You profiled one reviewer who was sued by Casper. What was the basis of that lawsuit? What happened there?
Sure. So the reviewer, the blogger, his name was Derek Hales. Still is Derek Hales. He lives in Arizona, and he had the most popular mattress reviewing website on the internet called Sleepopolis. Now, at one point, Derek Hales had these relationships with all the mattress companies he was reviewing, basically Casper, Lisa, all of them were paying him about $50 per mattress that he helped to sell. But at a certain point, when Casper became very successful, they canceled their relationship with Derek Hales and with other bloggers that were reviewing their product. And that created a situation where Derek Hales was, reviewing the Casper and the Lisa and other brands, and he was getting paid commissions by Lisa but not by Casper. And Casper felt that Derek was not sufficiently forthright about this situation where he was being paid more by some brands than others.
how common is it to use affiliate links in the world of e-commerce?
It's very common. this year alone, $4.5 billion will be spent on affiliate marketing. Affiliate marketing is a broad category. I think it comprises a little bit more than this situation of bloggers reviewing products. But really, if you Google kind of almost any product that you're interested in buying, and you Google, you know, mattress reviews or best water bottle, any of these queries that suggest to Google and to businesses that you are a person primed to buy something, there has more often than not been a kind of arms race to get a website to the top of Google that is often monetized through these affiliate links, as they're called.
And they pay, this is part something that they budget for. This is part of their marketing strategy.
Indeed. Yeah, I mean, in the case of Lisa, which is maybe the number two mattress e-commerce brand, Derek Hales, the blogger who was sued in the story that I read about, he affected 18% of Lisa's total $80 million in sales last year. So, yeah, millions and millions of dollars of sales affected by Derek Hales. And I think Lisa last year, if you run the math on that, paid Derek Hales, again, the proprietor of Sleepopolis.com at the time, something like $750,000that year, last year.
Not bad.
Not bad at all.
He claims he was the victim of a cyber warfare type tactic from Casper. What was going on there?
Yeah, well, the allegation, and it's unproven, but the allegation is that after Casper ceased payments to Sleepopolis, again, the review site, that there was a period of, Derek Hales and his lawyer alleged that there was a period where he and Casper were discussing maybe resuming a financial relationship. That conversation or that negotiation went south for whatever reason. And Derek Hales and his lawyer alleged that that Casper, and again, that's unproven, but the allegation is that there was a kind of cyber war waged against his website, where basically there was a campaign to sort of a smear campaign against the website that basically led to the website losing its top ranking in Google searches briefly.
But that's been unproven.
Well, there is evidence that I found that certainly there was this campaign. You can go online and you can see that, you know, there were links appearing to Sleepopolis in places that Google doesn't like, and that can hurt your rankings by association. You know, whether or not Casper was behind that those links, that is unproven.
Why? I guess it's obvious that most people, if they're buying a mattress, sit on it for a while and check it out at the store if they're buying it a bricks and mortar place. And that without the advantage of that, you have to rely on reviews more so with buying something on a mattress online. I'm wondering, why has this hit the mattress market so hard?
Well, I would say, you know, the story I told hopefully was especially vivid, but I would say battles like this and around affiliate marketing and sort of controlling the narrative online are probably pretty broad across e-commerce. I think any product, you're probably seeing struggles like this behind the curtain. In fact, I've been getting emails since my story came out about other industries where there are similar battles being waged. But I do think it's true that there is something unique about mattresses. It's sort of I don't want to say quite a last frontier, but maybe a new frontier in e-commerce. I think for years, you know, when Amazon got started, they started by selling books because, you know, you sort of understood what you were getting. It was understood how a book would be mailed to you. People were already mailing books to each other. Mm-hmm. And then as e-commerce has kind of cannibalized all of commerce over the last two decades, there's been this kind of rising tide of e-commerce where newer categories of products are, you know, categories that probably manufacturers wouldn't have ever believed could have been sold over the internet all of a sudden are. So who would have thought, you know, 5-10 years ago you could sell a mattress over the internet and people would buy it? But indeed, Casper and the other brands have proven that a lot of people are willing to do that if there is, you know, a generous return policy. So Casper, I believe, has a 100-day risk-free return policy. And also, if there's a sort of an ecosystem of reviews of people talking about the product online and sort of reassuring consumers. Now, as my story shows, that ecosystem of reviews is maybe less healthy and less independent than we might like.
Right. So how are we supposed to trust any of these places? How do you know? I mean, even if so, they divulge that they're an affiliate. What do you look for? I mean, how do you know?
You know, I really don't know, because a lot of these websites, as I said, are within the letter of the law. Currently, the FTC requires it's only a guideline, actually. It's not even, I don't know that it has the full force of law behind it, but the FTC guideline says you need to disclose if you are paid, you know, an affiliate commission, but it doesn't outline what you have to do if you're being paid, you know, X dollars by one company and 2X by the competitors. So really, I would say the regulatory framework right now is not in a position to ensure that online reviews are always on it. I would challenge your listeners to maybe go on reviews websites, but often you can email with the person behind the reviews website. Why not ask that person, you know, are you paid the same amount for all these commissions?
Mm-hmm.
That might be one way to begin to challenge people.
And do they ever actually have had to tested the mattress anyway?
They definitely do test the mattress. Indeed, one reason that a lot of these companies, a lot of these reviewers don't get in too much trouble is because they say, hey, I tested the mattress and I like the mattress and you're free to prove me wrong, but that's my opinion and my opinion is protected by the law. And, you know, mm-hmm. It may be the case that I'm paid way more by one mattress company versus another, but, you know, coincidence of coincidences, I also prefer that mattress. So that's sort of the situation we're in. But yes, I mean, so far as I know, I haven't uncovered a case of a leading mattress reviewer who hasn't actually tested the mattress.
There have been lawsuits between brick and mortar mattress stores and their online competitors, right?
Yeah, there's one that was just filed last week by Mattress Firm, which definitely dominates the mattress market overall in the U.S. against Tuft & Needle, which is a mattress e-commerce company that actually emerged before Casper, though it's a little less well known. Yeah, you have a situation where the mattress e-commerce companies are suing each other. The legacy brick and mortar companies are suing the e-commerce companies, and sometimes vice versa. And then you have a lawsuit like the one in my story, where a mattress e-commerce company sued a reviewer.
Besides just asking, any other advice?
You know, that's a good question. I walk away from the story, and I don't know to what extent I should trust online reviews. I guess the good news is, at least with mattress e-commerce, you can test the mattress, you can return it within 100 days. It's pretty low risk to you. The other good thing with e-commerce is that I do think the prices have come down. So if you look at the average mattress, e-commerce mattress, it's something like $1,000. Whereas if you go to a mattress store, sort of equivalent mattresses would probably be $1,500. So I guess the good news is that, you know, I think consumers are benefiting overall. It's just that there's this kind of weird ecosystem of reviews. And I just would like people to be skeptical about these review sites and to understand the financial incentives at work there. The other piece of advice I would have is I personally, you know, I sift information for a living. I'm a journalist. I realize not everyone, you know, has that luxury or privilege, but, you know, me personally, as someone who does this for a living, I tend to, I almost respect bloggers or websites that are really, really honest about their incentives, even if the incentives are suspicious. So I actually probably would trust even more a website that is really upfront with you about the fact that what they're doing is something between reviewing and advertising. The very fact that they're honest enough to be conspicuous about that disclosure suggests to me that they might be more honest with their reviews.
David Zacks, thanks so much for joining us. I appreciate your time.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
David Zacks is a contributing writer for Fast Company. We'll have a link to his article about online mattress and affiliate reviewers, affiliate links to reviewers that make money for their reviews. This is Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
the man.
The Monster Mash.
It was a graveyard smash.
Make it the mash.
It caught on in a flash.
Make it the mash.
They did the monster.
Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Dan Fisher. The season for jack-o'-lanterns, ghouls, and goblins is here. Joining us now to share some apps that help with the Halloween haunt is contributing editor at Android Central, Russell Holly. Welcome back, Russell.
Thank you.
So what are you wearing for a costume this year?
You know, I actually haven't decided yet. My kids are actually fighting about which costume they want me to wear, and that argument hasn't been resolved yet. So I have multiple options, but we haven't picked one yet because they have their own opinions on what I should be wearing.
So where do you wear your costume? Do you go to parties?
Yeah, no, I just kind of trudge down the street. I don't have like an office to go to. I just like walk to my 7-Eleven and talk to the people there.
Okay.
They're all really nice, and I confuse them quite a bit in my outfit, but you know, it works out.
I expect photos. One app you wanted to tell us about is called Zombies Run. Tell us about it.
Yeah, so this is something you can actually do anytime. It's just, you know, particularly Halloween-themed or, I guess, monster-themed. This is actually a running app, and it tells a story. It's an interactive story, where you're in this kind of post-apocalyptic zombie world. And so you put your headphones on, you have your phone in your pocket, and you go for a jog. And as you're running, the story continues to tell you what's going on. And zombies, the story is basically played out as those zombies are chasing you. And so you can actually look down at the map on your phone and see where they're coming from, and you can adjust your route as you're running to avoid them. So it's this total interactive experience that you have from your phone, and it really only looks like you're a crazy person running from no one if everyone knows what you're doing.
otherwise, but, it just looks like you're running.
Right. Otherwise, it just looks like you're running, and so you do get this kind of background story that is pretty entertaining. And the goal is that you run for about a half an hour each day. And you'll get this whole story within about a week.
Okay. Is it expensive?
No. This is a free app that you can download for both iPhone and for Android. It's been around for a really long time. It's improved quite a bit for people who have played the original version of the game and were kind of unimpressed. There really is kind of an impressive story that goes with it. You get to feel like you're running from zombies if that's the thing that you're into.
Well, I might be. I'm going to check that one out. You also wanted to talk about a digital version of a classic kids story, The Great Pumpkin. It's The Great Pumpkin, Charlie Brown. What's new? What's interactive about it?
Yeah, so this is, an interactive book, basically. It's the whole idea here is that there's some animated illustrations on the page that are very similar to the movie that just about everyone knows and loves. This one's just for the iPhone and iPad because it's, kind of the Apple digital books format, but it really just takes the movie and moves it into this, this more read aloud experience that you can share with your kids.
Let's see. Another app that might be fun for Halloween is a noise generator called My Noise. How does it work and what are the good spooky sounds?
My Noise gives you a ton of different options for things that you could play either through speakers in your house, or if you want to sneak up behind someone and see if you can make them wet themselves in public. You have a lot of options. But the thing that makes this app particularly impressive is that, you get this, kind of the poltergeist sound this dark world is what they call, some of this like background noisy chains clinking and things. But each one of these sounds has an array of sliders for different things happening in the background that you can make either louder or quieter. So if you want the chains rattling in the background to be a little louder than the moaning that you hear, you can actually adjust those sliders and kind of create your own, not entirely custom, but, kind of personalized creepy sound that you can even just play through Bluetooth speakers, out onto your front porch as people come to visit you on Halloween night.
I have a bowl with a head in it, and when you go to reach for candy, it starts moaning and saying, "Help me, help me." I've scared some kids badly. I usually have to put away halfway through the night. Another app for zombie fans is called The Walking Dead, Dead Yourself. This is a selfie app?
Yeah, it's a selfie app. You get kind of a face format that you line up your face with the stencil that's on the screen and you take a picture. and it will go through a bunch of special effects to mock your face up to look like one of the zombies from The Walking Dead. It gives you a bunch of different options, you know, based entirely on things that you have seen in the show or in the comics, if you read them, and is kind of impressively horrifying to see how well it will contort your face.
Now, have you done this?
I've done this a couple of times. My oldest daughter got a hold of my phone and did it once for herself. But yeah, it's reasonably scary to see, you know, what it's capable of
and what you would look like if.
Absolutely.
Yuck. You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Russell Holley, contributing editor for Android Central, and I are talking about apps for Halloween, spooky time of the year. If you have an idea of a question for them, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. In other tech news, NVIDIA has a new device that lets you turn your TV into a control center for your smart home devices. First of all, tell us about NVIDIA Shield TV. What is it?
Yeah, so the NVIDIA Shield TV is a set-top box that you plug into your television that gives you, you know, kind of the Android version of the Apple TV experience, where you've got the remote control, you can, you know, watch all your movies and play games and have access to a lot of your Android apps on your television, which ends up being really great depending on how you have it set up, because you have all of these different streaming apps in one place and you have a lot more control. But what NVIDIA has done here is actually partnered up with Samsung, their SmartThings architecture, and made it so that this little USB stick plugs into the back of your Shield TV, assuming that you already have one, and that $15 accessory then becomes your smart home hub. So you can connect to smart lights and door locks and just a ton of other accessories instead of paying for a normal smart home hub, which would normally be between $70 and $100. You're just taking this $15 accessory and plugging it into the back of your Shield TV.
Well, is it as good as that $70 to $100 operation?
It gives you the exact same experience from the testing that we've done so far. It relies on the Shield TV to be the computer part, and really just uses that wireless stick to handle the communication part, you know, where it's reaching out to all of the different accessories that you would have plugged into your house.
It sounds like a good way for people to kind of get started with smart home devices.
Right, yeah, I mean, that's the idea here. And the cool thing about the way Samsung does this is that, you know, long term, it doesn't have to be just something that works with the NVIDIA Shield TV. They've taken all of the smarts and offloaded it to another thing, which means you really can, you know, take this USB stick, you know, eventually and make it, you know, something that you can plug into a lot of other things. And it's a direction that I'm hoping that Samsung goes in, is to just make the hub part a lot less work for people. So it's just, you know, plugging this thing in instead of, you know, having to have a separate app on your phone that controls this box that's plugged in somewhere special.
Does this have things like security measures like Ring does, where someone rings your doorbell? Or enters your house, you are notified?
It can. If you have a doorbell connected to your home, then yes, you can have those features enabled. You have to have something that communicates with the SmartThings hub in order to do that.
Okay.
You know, it's a lot of flexibility there as far as what you can connect to it. And a lot of those security features are based on having those individual accessories in the first place.
Okay. Microsoft just released details on its new Surface Book laptops. The original Surface Book, tell us what that was like and then compare and contrast it to the two new sizes.
Yeah, so the original Surface Book did this really weird thing where, you know, Microsoft kind of decided that they were taking the Surface idea, where it was a tablet that could sometimes be a laptop, and kind of flipping that around, where it was a laptop most of the time and then you could have it be a tablet when you wanted. And this was important for a couple of reasons. The first was that it was a laptop that meant that you could actually use it on your lap. Which is a weird thing to be excited about. But with the Surface line of, you know, kind of laptop hybrid, all of the weight for the laptop was on the back of the machine and didn't have it like a hinge like you would expect in a normal laptop. So actually setting this thing on your lap was complicated. And that was something that they fixed with the Surface Pro. So this latest version, they've taken that idea and they've extended it further. They've made it available in two different sizes. You know, you have a 13-inch size and a 15-inch size. So you have people like me who kind of prefer the smaller laptop without having a lot of performance decreases, you know, can have that now instead of having just the bigger laptop. And then the people who are interested in something that is more traditionally laptop-shaped can have the larger 15-inch version.
They have the new USB Type-C port on them. We've talked about that before, but refresh our memories. What's the diff there?
USB Type-C is a strange little oval port that you're going to see on just about everything coming out this coming year. Maybe not as the only port on it like you would see with a MacBook right now, but definitely included in just about every laptop that's going to come out here in the next year. And it is a data port in many different laptops. It's also a power port. It is a unique kind of futuristic piece of technology here in that it is capable of doing a lot of things that we used to rely on multiple ports to do. And so you wind up with, like a MacBook, for example, has just these USB Type-C ports. So it just looks like you have a series of ovals on the side of your computer. And each one of those ports can be used to either power the laptop or connect to multiple devices or even connect straight to a television, from this port. And it's something that Microsoft is being a lot more reserved about, just replacing every port with. And a lot of Microsoft's partners are doing the same. So you're only going to see the one USB Type-C port on this laptop. But as we move into the next year, it's going to become a lot more common to see these oval ports on things.
So talk about the power and performance of the Surface Books. Are they top tier? Who are they for?
These are definitely top tier machines. As far as the performance goes, these are actually the thinnest and lightest machines that can actually power entire virtual reality systems. Whereas typically that was something that you would see in a desktop or in kind of a bulky gaming laptop.
Mm-hmm.
Microsoft has done this, through this very kind of thin and light machine. So it exceeds the power performances of just about every of the MacBook line that's out there right now. Even the smaller 13-inch version is pretty considerably powerful as far as what's inside of it.
So is this a function of a better battery?
No, this is, the battery is certainly part of the experience here, but really it was just Microsoft's engineering to shrink down these more powerful video cards and processors.
Okay.
to make sure that they fit in this without causing heat problems or anything like that.
How do they compare to Apple laptops in terms of price and performance?
Their pricing is definitely similar. They're going to start at around the $1,000 mark, and they're going to increase pretty considerably depending on what it is that you want in them, which is very similar to Apple's pricing. As far as performance goes, like mm-hmm. I said, even the smaller version of this is as powerful as the top of the line, most expensive machine that you're going to get from Apple.
Okay. The Google Pixel 2 XL screen controversy. Talk about that. There's a problem called burn-in.
Yeah, so this is something that you normally see on a phone or a laptop or a television, pretty much any kind of display after a couple of years of use.
Yeah.
Where an image is kind of stuck in a corner or something like that because it's been left on the screen for too long. But there's something about Google's display for the Pixel XL 2, which is an LG-made display, that is actually causing this effect on some phones, not every Pixel XL 2, but on some phones within as little as a week of use, where this kind of image effect, particularly the bottom navigation, those three buttons that you see on the bottom of just about every Android phone, seem to be kind of stuck there. And Google has said that they're investigating the issue, but it's really an impressive thing to be concerned about. When you consider that these are things that you normally see on a display after a long period of use, and they're showing up here in almost the exact same fashion after a week of use.
Right. I mean, that's a big deal. Google's looking into it, but are people asking for their money back?
There have been people who have asked for exchanges and returns, and people who are still had their phones on pre-order who have just kind of outright canceled them and gone with the smaller version of the Pixel 2 instead of the XL because it has a different display that's made by a different company and does not have this problem.
What are the suspected causes?
This gets a little too far into how OLED technology works for me to give a clear answer. It's something that I've talked to a couple of display experts on, and the explanation so far is we just need to run more tests to figure out exactly what the cause is here. So there aren't a whole lot of people who know exactly what's going on yet, just that it is not good to show a persistent black image on this screen for particularly long.
Oh, so it's a particular kind of image.
So usually that's what you end up getting with this kind of thing. It's anything that stays on the screen in one place without moving at all for an extended period of time will cause this. And the only thing that really does that on this particular Android phone is the navigation bar that goes across the bottom of the phone.
Okay.
Because it's this black strip that never goes anywhere.
Wow. How much does this phone cost?
This is an $850 phone.
Yikes.
Yeah. So it's definitely not good. And if you were considering, you know, either the Pixel 2 or the Pixel 2 XL, right now the recommendation is to consider the smaller version of the phone. Not only is it $200 cheaper, but it has a screen made by an entirely different company that we have confirmed does not have this problem.
Were you kind of high on the Pixel phones?
I really enjoy both of these phones. The thing that's happening to this display makes me very sad on the inside.
Has it happened to yours?
There is a slight version of this on my phone. It's not as not as pronounced as several of the other phones that I have seen this problem on. So there's a little hope here that it is not affecting every phone, but for it to have affected as many phones as I have seen it affect so far is definitely not good.
Jeez. It's not blowing up, though. I mean, upside.
That is a low bar.
Well,
you have to look at your phone and go, well, at least it's not blowing up. Yeah.
Well, yeah, I mean, it just you just wonder. I mean, whether it was where it was manufactured, if that had something to do with it.
Yeah, there are a lot of questions being looked into right now. This is something that was discovered on Sunday, this burn-in issue. And so there's been a lot of research done in the meantime. And hopefully there will be some actual answers from Google and Google's hardware partner before the end of the week.
Well, we've got a couple minutes left, and I was just wondering what's coming up this week to look forward to talking about next week.
So the biggest thing happening this week is that Microsoft is kind of pushing out their whole Windows mixed reality strategy, which is all of their virtual reality headsets. They worked with, you know, 9 different companies to have all of these different headsets out by Christmas and to have all of these things on display in a bunch of different places. And so this week in particular, if you walk into Best Buy stores or if you walk into a Microsoft store or, you know, electronic stores that are going to carry these, you're going to see new displays for trying out virtual reality headsets. And if you move really just further into the holiday season, we're going to see a lot of the same thing from HTC and from Samsung, Sony for PlayStation VR. So it's going to be really interesting. I'm curious to see how far you can get kind of walking into a store this holiday season without being able to see some kind of virtual reality display, and whether that means more people are going to be buying headsets because they're able to actually try them out.
Exactly. We shall see. Russell Holly, thanks as always. Appreciate your time today.
Thank you for having me.
Russell Holly, contributing editor for Android Central. That's it for Tech Tuesday today. Thanks so much for listening. This has been All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.